We've already expanded good time credits affecting the jail. What's in this bill, if I understand it correctly, affects those who are sentenced in the Bureau of Prisons. The compassionate release is focused, if I remember correctly, on older inmates. It would be inmates who have served a significant amount of time or they have an illness.
That's D.C. Council Chairman Phil Mendelson today talking about releasing some inmates at the D.C. jail because of the COVID-19 threat. Last month, 50 nonviolent offenders were released from the Prince George's County Jail to help with social distancing. And just today, an employee from the Montgomery County Department of Corrections tested positive for COVID-19, a reminder that corrections workers are also at risk. Well, what's being done to protect the incarcerated from the coronavirus? Well, joining me to talk about this are D.C. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton and Thomas Harvey, Justice Project Director with the Advancement Project and one of the people behind the Free Them Now initiative. If you have a comment or a question about this, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can certainly tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. I want to thank both of you for joining me on the call. Let me start with Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton. Congresswoman, can you talk to me a little bit about where we are in the district as far as the possibility of releasing some nonviolent offenders from the D.C. jail? I know the council is going to be addressing some of that with a consensus bill vote tomorrow.
I believe that's going to happen. That's a home rule issue. I am, and the council, I think, is going to make, I've already called, I put out a release saying that people arrested for misdemeanors and those who are nonviolent offenders, along with a host of others who it seems to me don't need to be held at this point in the crowded quarters of jails. But that is a home rule issue, and I think you see the D.C. Council moving on that. Mm-hmm. My concern is with Hope Village, when our residents who are in prison are imprisoned all over the country by the Bureau of Prisons. They are sent back to Hope Village. That's a place to they're still incarcerated. Some of them go out to work from there. And by the way, we've been able to get somebody to say that instead of having to pay 25% of their pay to the halfway house, they can, at least for this period, keep it. The point is, though, that they come from all over the country. They come to the halfway house here in the District of Columbia. I have written to the Bureau of Prisons, which controls the halfway house, indicating that I believe that those inmates, at least most of them, instead of being held in close quarters in the halfway house, should all be released. There will be a few that have other reasons why they can't be released. But remember, these people are getting out of prison anyway. Why hold them in close quarters? Now, we're fortunate that while there have been three deaths, they have not been from the virus. But they have to eat together. If that virus gets into Hope Village, it could be an epidemic there. Why in the world would we want to allow that possibility? So I have written the Bureau of Prisons to just clear it out, except those who have to be there. I've also asked the Federal Bureau of Prisons to make an unannounced visit, an unannounced site visit at the halfway house here in the District of Columbia.
Let me ask you, what kind of response have you received from the Federal Bureau of Prisons since you're sending this letter to them?
Well, they have responded, but they have not done what I have asked them to do, which is to make an unannounced site visit. there. For example, you can understand that there must be crowded conditions because Hope Village has opened up a building to allow for more space, indicating that they themselves know there's not enough space. So I want an unannounced visit from the Bureau of Prisons because I want to know whether or not Hope Village is following the guidelines of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I think we need an outside entity to assure us that Hope Village is safe and that people coming back are coming to safe quarters. It seems to me this is the time for them not to come back there, but to, for those who have homes, to let them go to those homes.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about protecting the incarcerated from the coronavirus pandemic. If you have a comment or if you have a question, give us a call. Lines are open right now. Quickly, Congresswoman Norton, certainly your immediate focus is Hope Village, but I would argue that there are Hope Village-type facilities all across this country. Do you believe that the Bureau of Prisons and by extension the Trump administration is focusing enough on this really fast-moving issue?
I don't think that the administration has given any thought to this issue. I've seen nothing from the federal government or the president. You're right about Hope Village being duplicated all over the United States, at least if they are in federal prisons. But consider that most of we're in a unique position because the district, when it became insolvent, decided that certain of its state functions should be essentially funded by the federal government. That's why we are unique in having our prisoners in prisons, in a federal prison. Now, consider if you are in a state, they are in state prisons, normally far from home, but they also are under circumstances where they live in close quarters and where the virus can be easily spread.
I want to bring Mr. Harvey into this conversation. Mr. Harvey, first of all, briefly explain to me what the Free Them Now initiative is.
Yes, thank you so much for inviting me on the show.
Sure.
I'm honored to be here. We have a campaign called Free and Safe Now, and we're trying to work with several jurisdictions across the country with local organizers to do exactly what the Congresswoman is talking about in cities like St. Louis, Missouri, Miami, Florida, Detroit, Michigan, East Baton Rouge, and Louisiana, where we've got people who are concerned about the conditions and the threat of COVID-19 to people who are incarcerated currently, whether they are pretrial or post-trial. And our goal is to work with these organizers like Michigan Liberation and St. Louis, Action St. Louis, in order to get people out of jail if we can, and for those who remain to ensure that they get the protections they need in order to avoid contracting the deadly COVID-19 coronavirus. So that is the campaign right now. And we have a website up, freeandsafenow.org, that folks can go to if they'd like to hear a little more about it.
I want to come back to that in a moment, but I do want to go to the phone lines at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking about protecting the incarcerated from the coronavirus. What is being done locally? What is being done nationally? How should this issue be addressed? Let's go to Michael. Michael, calling from Maryland. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hello, yes. My concern is that my brother, who is elderly, he is scheduled to be released in August, but they put the home visit on hold because of the coronavirus. And now, with that being the case, I'm concerned that I don't know when he's going to be released or when they're going to get out to do the visit. And he has pre-existing conditions.
Mm-hmm. Where is he, Michael?
I'm sorry. Can you repeat that, please?
Where is your brother?
He's located in Virginia in a I can't remember exactly where it is, but it is a federal prison. It's a federal institution in Virginia.
I see. Congresswoman Norton, can you at least try to kind of address that? Because I will say I'm not surprised that the home visit process has been put on hold to kind of address the spread of COVID-19. But what about communications with loved ones and the like through the federal system?
Yeah, I think this caller raises an important point because his brother, like our residents, is in a federal prison. And almost always it is very difficult to visit those prisons because they're located far from home. It does seem to me that there should be, I know there are phones in those prisons. I don't believe they are allowed to keep cell phones and the rest. But I would suggest that this caller call his member of the House or the Senate for information on how he can get word about the condition of his brother and what is being done to make sure that he is able to come home in August.
Okay.
That's what Congress is here for.
Michael, thank you so much for your phone call. Back to the halfway house situation, even though in Prince George's County, we were talking about the county jail, but the 50 inmates who were released last month were nonviolent offenders and people who, for example, had had short time. They were given some good time leave. But if you're in a half house, for those who aren't familiar with it, isn't that the next step to freedom? Do you believe that because of the coronavirus, Congresswoman, that since they are now at this step, that they should just be let go? Or do you believe that only a handful of them should be eligible to be released from the halfway house system?
I believe that virtually all of them should be let go. They have served their time. The only reason they are in a halfway house in the first place is to acclimate them to what they need to do on the outside in civil society. We are facing a pandemic, which means that when they get out of prison, we are now exposing them to danger, a health danger. Now, some of them may need to be held over for other reasons, but the great majority of people in halfway houses here, and if I may say so, around the country, should be let go to go home. Now, there may be something different if we're talking about people who have no home, and therefore you'd have to work to see where they would go, for example, simply letting them go and fill up the shelters may make a bad situation worse. But here in the halfway house in the District of Columbia, located in Ward 8 of our city, I believe that the majority of those people on their way home should be sent home, and that those who would have to go to a shelter may have to remain in the halfway house, which may be all right because it would thin out the overcrowding, and they should not simply be let go into a shelter unless it has become clear that there's room for them. Now, I have posted on I have tweeted that the District of Columbia is allowing people in shelters to be housed, or at least some of them, in hotels around the District of Columbia. Yeah. That shows you that there is an understanding that keeping people in close quarters in a halfway house, or for that matter, in a shelter, is to virtually invite the virus in.
Before I go back to Mr. Harvey, I want to take another phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking about protecting the incarcerated from the coronavirus. Let's go to Antoinette, calling from D.C. Antoinette, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, how you doing? My name
Fine,
is Antoinette Williamson, and I'm from Washington, D.C., Washington, and my son is, too. My son name is Deontay Nelly. He graduated from high school in the Northeast high school system. Never had a record, anything. He ended up meeting this girl online.
Well, hold on, Antoinette. What's your question? I've got a lot of folks on the line. Please just tell me what your question is.
He's incarcerated right now for a domestic violence charge. He's never had a record, ever. They had him down for domestic violence, cruelty to a child. Which
okay,
is this
Antoinette, I'm going to ask you one more time. What is your question?
My question is, how can I get him from Georgia up to D.C.? Like, they're not answering the phones. They're not answering calls. Everything is shut down. His trial date was set back to July. I mean, like, they got COs, well, and they're coughing really bad.
Let me see if Mr. Harvey can address that, because I think this is, you know, just one story, Mr. Harvey, and a broader saga of how the COVID-19 pandemic is affecting all systems, but particularly the prison system.
Yes, unfortunately, what Antoinette said is very typical of what we're seeing right now. And fundamentally, the sad truth is our society is reflecting that we simply don't care about the people who are locked up in our prisons and jails. Officials are very slow to respond. They're not answering phone calls. They're not responding to family requests. They've locked down the jail so that it's even more difficult than it previously was to get any access to information. And they're not taking the steps that are necessary to reduce the jail population and the prison population so that social distancing is possible. But they're also not providing people with adequate hand soap, with antibacterial soap, with sanitizer. They have no ability. These folks are not like me and you who could clean their own space with having access to these cleaning supplies. They rely on someone else to give them those materials and to clean them. And those are not being provided in many jurisdictions across the country. And it's a very sad, devastating truth for those of us who have family in prison or those of us who are trying to work with people to get people out. It's that our society is reflecting that even in the middle of this pandemic, these are the last folks in the world that we care about. And that's why we're trying to file these lawsuits that we're filing across the country in order to get people out through Advancement Project and working with our partners. I think it's really important to note that jails and prisons are especially dangerous places to be during a pandemic. It is impossible to socially distance in a jail or prison. It's a place that's designed for a lot of people to be in a very small area so that correctional officers can observe them. People are handling food there. There are people in and out of the facility all day who could bring the virus in. Correctional officers contract the virus, go home to their communities, infect other people. It's an incredibly dangerous place for this virus to be. And once it gets in, we're going to see things like we're seeing in Rikers Island and in the Cook County Jail and in Miami, and that we're seeing all over the country where there are massive levels of infection, and soon people will be dying. And if we don't act very quickly to get them out, this is just going to be an incredible indictment of our society.
Mr. Harvey, I'm going to be continuing with you after the break. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, thank you so much for your participation in the project, in the conversation. Of course, we will continue to stick with you in the coming weeks and indeed months as this issue and so many others become relevant to our conversation. So thank you again. I really appreciate you, Congresswoman
Eleanor
Holmes Norton.
Also,
I want to thank
you for discussing this important issue. Goodbye.
Absolutely. Antoinette, hang on. I want to see if I can try to get you a bit of a suggestion from Mr. Harvey. But for those of you listening, please stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM, channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. This conversation will continue on Sirius XM, channel 141. The Quiet Storm, the original Quiet Storm with Angela Stribling is next on WHUR. But stay with us. This conversation continues in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we're discussing the protection of the incarcerated amid the coronavirus pandemic. My guest is Thomas Harvey. He is the Justice Project Director with the Advancement Project and one of the people behind the Free and Safe Now initiative. If you have a question or a comment about the protection of inmates amid the COVID-19 pandemic, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Mr. Harvey, we lost Antoinette, but I do want to continue with the point that you were discussing before the break. Can you drill down a little bit more about the severity of the problem for not just the incarcerated, obviously, but also those who work around them in the midst of this pandemic?
Definitely. I think it's important to keep in mind just how rapidly this virus has been spreading. So if you think about the fact that in the United States, we've gone from one case in January to nearly 400,000 today, and that we have nearly 10,000 people who have died from COVID-19 with an estimated death toll of potentially 240,000 Americans, what we know is when you see that kind of spread, once someone has contracted the virus, whether it's someone you've come into contact with, someone you're in close association with, we can reasonably predict that other people in that environment are going to get it. And if you think about Rikers Island, like I mentioned, they were held there in March of 2019. There was one case on March 18th. That was the first case in Rikers Island. And I believe it was a correctional officer who had the first case. By April 4th, so something like 15 days later, 273 staff members and 321 people inside were infected. Four correctional officers have died in Rikers, and one detainee has now died. And more than 800 people incarcerated there are held in incarceration. So this is in quarantine right now, what they call quarantine within the jail environment. But the fact is, this is just an environment that's ready-made for the spread of the virus. Whether we're talking about jails or prisons or halfway houses, these areas where people are put into cramped quarters and have no choice, no ability to social distance, and don't have regular access to cleaning supplies to wash their hands and to clean their own areas, and who are reliant on other people coming into their environment to deliver food and to let them go to the shower. They're constantly in contact with people. They don't have the masks that are recommended. They're just unable to protect themselves. And fundamentally, even if the jail or prison might be able to provide some semblance of what's required in terms of cleaning supplies, it's simply impossible to maintain 6 feet of difference between you and another person in a jail or prison in America right now.
Let me go back to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Adrian, calling from Maryland. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask a question about, I have a family member who's in the correctional treatment facility in D.C., and I'm constantly given information. Like today I got information that they should contact their public defenders because they are now putting signs up saying there's no, that they should call the public defender. There's no soap and different things. And the person who's there, my family member, doesn't really. They really don't have. I guess they started using a quarantine protocol maybe like when they would put them all together, they moved them all, but then they were taking two out or three out when they found out that they had been, you know, affected or some kind of way. But I want to know if anything is being done. My family member has already been, has like 2 weeks left to even get out. They've already gotten their clearance as far as their home visit. All that's been taken care of. They have
let me
and they're just kind of afraid of contracting it and then coming out.
Well, let me help you with that. Is it Adrian or Andrian?
It's Adrian.
Adrian. Okay, Adrian. So what happened today, and I was able to view Mayor Bowser's press conference today in conjunction with D.C. Council Chair Phil Mendelson. Tomorrow, the D.C. Council is supposed to vote on something called a consensus bill, a little technical issue there, but because of the pandemic and the fact that the council has to literally hold these meetings from home, from their individual homes and the like, it's not like they're sitting in the council chambers. But one of the things that they are going to address, and I certainly invite you to kind of keep your ear to the ground, we're going to also, you know, do our level best to get the latest information on this as it happens. They're supposed to be voting on the possibility of what they call good time credits and compassionate release of inmates from the DC jail. Now, this does not really apply to your relative. I'm assuming that he is a younger man. He is not a someone who has been in the system for very, very long. Is that correct?
No, he's been in the system for a long time. He's there on a parole violation.
But how old is he?
50.
Okay, so we're talking about the senior citizen community of the DC jail, for example. That would be the compassionate release part. But if he is 2 weeks out, certainly, you know, as a loving family member, you want to get him out of there yesterday. I understand that. And so it is quite possible that, you know, good time credits and short timers and the like could very well be released as a result of how the DC Council votes on this consensus bill. That's the first thing. The second thing that happened today, and this not only applies to your family member, but for those who may not be getting out because of compassionate release or good time credits. And the mayor was asked about soap, cleaning products, and the like. She did not have an answer. She did say that she would look into it, as we have seen over the past several weeks as a result of this. Mayor Bowser has moved very, very swiftly to address all issues surrounding the coronavirus as it relates to the things that are under her purview. And so I would believe that we should be also getting an answer about that. If not tomorrow, we could very well hear something later on during the course of this week about how sanitary conditions and cleanliness will be handled going forward at the DC jail. And so I know that's not the immediate answer that you may be looking for, but that did happen today. It's happening tomorrow. So again, you know, I certainly recommend that you kind of keep your ears to the ground as well as into WHUR as we report on these things as they happen.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome. Thank you for calling. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. One thing, Mr. Harvey, we lost Antoinette before the break, and she's back on the line. And I wanted to get, if you had any kind of suggestion. She said that I believe her son is in Georgia, and no matter what his violation may be, what is the best way for her to communicate with a correctional facility under these circumstances in Georgia when she is here?
I am not familiar with the Georgia area right now, but I would say that I don't know if your loved one is represented by an attorney. That would be my first bet. My second suggestion would be I know this is too slow, but writing them, I think that I could also, I'm happy to give my contact information off the air. I'd be happy to talk to Antoinette further about some of the organizations we work with there and see if we might be able to support her efforts. I apologize. I just am not familiar with that area. It is what Antoinette's talking about is just so hard because one of the first things that jails and prisons have done is restrict access to them. And that has resulted in family members and loved ones not being able to find out what's going on. And if you happen to be an attorney, you may have some access to the jail. But other than that, it's extremely difficult to get in touch with people right now because without having the regular contact visits, the normal contact visits, there are a limited number of times during the day that they're allowing people to make phone calls in and out of the jail or the facilities. So mm-hmm. I think I would contact them and ask them what that procedure is. But then again, I'm happy to give my contact information off air and we could talk further.
Also, my producer is going to get her phone number as well. So at the end of the program, if you after 8 o'clock, if you don't mind, she can make sure that she gets that information to you as well. As it relates to the bigger issue of this initiative, Free and Safe Now, of course, we will be posting information on the WHUR.com website. But is there a website that you can share with us right now for those who are interested in finding out more?
I think it is freeandsafenow.org is the name of the website. And there you can find out about all of our initiatives, all of the organizing partners we're working with. What's been most inspiring to me during this crisis is the way that places like Action St. Louis and the East Baton Rouge Parish Prison Reform Coalition, Michigan Liberation, and Dream Defenders have all stepped up in their communities to really take a risk and try to organize and put pressure on local officials to release people. And Advancement Projects is just thrilled to be able to support their efforts through lawsuits in St. Louis and Miami and in the coming weeks, in the coming week, hopefully Detroit and East Baton Rouge, to try to get people free. I think that I did want to come back to this one question that the earlier caller asked.
Mm-hmm. Go right ahead.
To Washington, D.C. I think her name is Adrian. She should contact her loved one's public defender also. People are filing what are called habeas petitions, which essentially just ask the court to release someone because the jail has, by the definition of the conditions in it right now, violated their constitutional rights. And so it's likely that someone has filed that or could file that on behalf of her loved one. The other thing is there is a class action lawsuit against the jail right now, very similar to the ones that we brought in Miami over the weekend. And what's really unique about this so far is that the correctional officers have added their voice to their concern, to the concerns about what's going on in the jail. They also were not being protected. I think it's obvious to all of us who are familiar with those environments that they're in with the folks who are detained and it's impossible to separate. And so they have some very strong allegations about the control of the jail and the danger that it poses to both the people who are inside and the people who are working. And I think to Mayor Bowser's actions, I'm not very familiar with everything she's done, but I can just say that we really don't have days or weeks to address this. In the upcoming week or two, when people start dying in these jails and prisons, the people who run them will tell us, now you can't get anyone out because we know they have the virus and it's too much of a threat to the outside. So first they're saying you can't get in to find out what's going on, and they haven't tested anyone. So they tell us no one's tested positive because they haven't tested anyone. And then once someone does die, they'll say, now we can't get anyone out because we know they have the virus. So this is the moment to really double down and push forth any efforts people have to try to get people out right now.
And actually, a federal judge is scheduled to take up that D.C. jail case on tomorrow. And so there are so many fast-moving parts in this. And so, certainly that is something else that we're going to try to keep our ears to the ground to make sure that we have that information coming out. You talked about so much I do want to go back to the phone lines. Let's talk to Stephanie calling from New Haven, Connecticut. Stephanie, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I was calling to find out a name and phone number of a contact person here in Connecticut that I can contact regarding my son who's currently incarcerated, nonviolent crime.
Is that federal or is that a
state?
So he's at a state prison. So, and so again, you know, Mr. Harvey, you know, obviously, you know, that's a very specific case, but under these particular circumstances, again, would you mind sharing with Stephanie your best advice for getting information right now?
My best advice is to try to contact the facility directly, and and it's going to be a long and difficult process because they're incredibly bureaucratic and slow to move on a good day, and now they're in the middle of something that they can't handle. So what you have to do is contact them and find out what the options are to speak with your loved one and then follow up on that. The other course of action is if your son is represented by an attorney, they're often able to get faster access. I don't know, you know, without knowing more about his case and the circumstances, I wouldn't be able to help more than that. I apologize. I wish I had a better answer for you, but I think, you know, just being persistent with the facility that's holding him and trying to find out how you should be able to get access by phone or video. And I believe at this, I don't know if Connecticut's one of the states, many states are making these calls free now, as opposed to trying to exploit people who are trying to contact folks in the middle of a pandemic. So I hope that you would be able to do that. And again, I'm also happy to give my contact information offline and I could follow up with to see if we know anyone there.
And actually, again, we will be able to post the website for a free and safe now. And I'm sure that someone can go through the website for free and safe now, the Advancement Project, to reach you. Is that correct, Mr. Harvey?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Stephanie, for your phone call. I want to talk a little bit more about this process, not only free and safe now, but just kind of knocking around in your head what we're beginning to see from counties, for example, in the release of nonviolent offenders and the compassionate release initiatives that we're seeing. On the surface, it sounds great, but what do you say to people who are concerned about even the nonviolent offenders, about safety in their communities once these people are released under these unique circumstances?
The first thing I would say is that people who are in jails and prisons are part of our communities. We're not separate from people who are in jails and prisons right now. We know them. They're our brothers and sisters and our parents and our children. They are our community. So I would, you know, the first thing I'd say is that this is a part of our community and we need to do everything we can to hold that part of our community that's especially vulnerable right now. The second thing I'd say is that there's a sense in our country that we're overrun with violent crime, and this is just not true. I'm not minimizing the fact that there is real violence and that people live in areas where people are killed regularly. I'm not minimizing that at all. That's a very difficult challenge that all of us face who want to see people coming back from jails and prisons, dealing with the community members who are afraid and for very good reasons. I think that in part, we have to turn our attention to how our society has been constructed and the conditions that have been created that have led to the kind of acts that we call crimes in this country and work on that. Now, simultaneous to that, we have to figure out a way for people who are leaving jails and prisons to come home and to have the best, safest way for them to reintegrate into broader society. And I think it's a valid concern. I don't want to minimize the fear, but I think ultimately we're talking about bringing people back into a community And we've got to figure out a way to do that, because but for a very small number of people who are in our jails and prisons, they're all coming home. Everyone is coming home. Whether it's now or later, they're all coming home. And so this is a good time for us to start figuring out how we're going to do this in the right way for everyone.
Now, that certainly is a valid argument. But usually when we see, for example, in county correction houses, you may see one or two or five people perhaps released on any given day. But as I mentioned in the example last month in Prince George's County, which is the county that immediately abuts Washington, D.C. to the east, we're talking about 50 nonviolent offenders in one day. Let's assume for this conversation that safety as it relates to criminal acts is not an issue for the community and these 50 individuals. But in this age of COVID-19, what happens to these individuals if they don't have a home to go to? And I'm quite sure you've seen that homeless shelters are considered, at least anecdotally, hotspots for the coronavirus. And so the other issue is, what happens to these people when they are released and they don't have a home to go to?
That's a very good question. And I think the partial answer is, in almost every state and city in America, the head official, whether it's the governor or the mayor, has declared a state of emergency. In many of these states, that declaration of a state of emergency creates power to take property and use it in order to protect the public health. Now, this is an extreme thing, but in California, for example, the governor's made it very clear that hotels can be used, can be seized and used in order to treat people who have COVID-19. So I think similarly, it's not outrageous in any way to say, if we can put people who are suffering from this virus in this, why couldn't we give housing to the people who we're trying to protect from that virus if they don't have another place to go? Now, I think homelessness is another, indictment of our society. It's no reason in this world for one of the richest nations in the world to have people who are unable to have housing. But this is an opportunity also for us to provide safe housing where people can get the kind of care they need when they come out of these jails. Because as you're saying, releasing 50 people, and I don't know if these folks were held prior to a conviction, but if they were, they probably never should have been in that jail to begin with. That's another thing. Why did they say these 50 people could get out? I bet it has something to do with the low-level nature of their charge, and it was nonviolent. So they never should have been in jail to begin with, I imagine.
Some of these were held for nonviolent offenses. They were charged with low level offenses, and right. I think that was one of the things that assisted in allowing this to move so quickly. And I think that's, because the other piece, as was mentioned today in the District of Columbia for the D.C. jail, good time credits suggests that there was a conviction, and right. and so being, good behavior, whatever you want to call it, that's one of the things that they are considering. Also, the compassionate release, those people are also convicted. But the situation in Prince George's County, I believe the lion's share of them were facing nonviolent charges, but had not yet been convicted. And that brings me to my next point. That's kind of a hodgepodge of situations amid the coronavirus pandemic. Moving forward, how do we address this issue of keeping the incarcerated safe after we've allowed the nonviolent offenders to go home, that we have allowed good time credit offenders or inmates to go home, you know, and so then you have what's left. Does that mean that the prison system is now good? Because certainly there's always a good supply of those coming in to the system. Do we now give tickets or citations to nonviolent offenders to keep them out as they are accused of these crimes? What do you think?
Yes, I would recommend that. I think many of the steps that we've seen sheriffs and prosecuting attorneys and chiefs of police take are things that should be applied on a daily basis. We lead the entire world in locking up and caging our citizens. We're by far the world leader in caging our own people. And this disproportionately impacts people of color in the United States, as I think everyone is familiar with. And it's just, we should adopt those principles, period. I want to come back to something that you said about, you know, once we are able to get folks out on compassionate release and the nonviolent stuff, I think we have to really ask ourselves the question, if the people who, even the people who have been convicted, even of a violent case, are what we saying as a society that it's okay for those people to die in the prison because we're more afraid of them getting out than we care about their health and well-being? Unless they're facing a death sentence, every one of them was going to come home to a family member and to a community. And so I think even the people, this is a very difficult challenge for us as a moral question. What do we do with the people who are remaining in the facilities after we've gone through these sort of low-hanging fruit of the nonviolent and the compassionate release? What do we do about that? And what does that say about us as a nation if we essentially say we're okay with those people dying? I'm not sure what that means about us. I think it's really difficult to believe that prisons and jails can adequately protect people's health in a pandemic. It's extremely hard for them to do it in a regular day. On their best day, people die in jail and prison across this country all the time. And I just don't think they're equipped in any way. And I don't want to say I just don't think it. There's dozens of medical professionals who believe prisons and jails are the perfect place for a virus to spread and a place where people are not going to be able to get the treatment they need because of inadequate health care.
I think that's such a valid point that you just made, that even under the best of circumstances, it is difficult to protect the health and the welfare of people in the prison population, as well as those that are working amongst the prison population. But this pandemic has literally changed everything, and the prison system is not immune to that. I think that's an excellent point, and I think that's a good place for us to end this conversation. I do want to thank you, Thomas Harvey, with the Advancement Project. Thank you for talking to us, and I also want to make sure that we remind you to please stay safe.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. That is The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, Channel 141, for this Monday, April 6th. I'm Harold Fisher. Now, stay tuned for The Connection. And remember, stay safe.